On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I've had to make statements like this too many times. As a country, we have been through this too many times. We've endured too many of these tragedies in the past few years.
This could have been any one of our communities.
Whether it's an elementary school in Newton or a temple in Wisconsin or a movie theater in Aurora.
This massacre is therefore a further reminder of how easy it is for someone to get their hands on a weapon that lets them shoot people in a school or in a house of worship or in a nightclub. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. And we have to decide if that's the kind of country we want to be.
I think so many Americans sometimes feel as if there's nothing we can do about it.
And to actively do nothing is a decision as well.
President Obama, after Sandy Hook, Charleston, San Bernardino, and now Orlando, the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. Gunman Omar Mateen killed 49 people early Sunday morning at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. The victims include a college student, a UPS worker, a bouncer who had moved to Orlando to help her mother and grandmother. One victim, a 30-year-old accountant named Eddie Justice, texted his mother Mina during the attack. Here she is speaking to the Associated Press.
He texted me at 2:06 and said, "Mommy, I love you." In the club, there's shooting. That was at 2:06. Trapped in the bathroom, downtown. Please call police. I'm going to die.
Well, joining me now to talk about some of the victims are Alex Dougherty and Emily Cochran, reporters for the Miami Herald. They spent the last day reporting on the victims, and they join me now. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Well, first, generally, you've been coming through social media as part of your reporting to find out who the victims were. What kinds of comments are you seeing?
For sure, the overwhelming emotion is just grief. Most of these victims were fairly young in terms of they were in their mid-20s, early 30s. Someone was even as young as 19. So a lot of people are just devastated that lives were taken right before they could really establish their careers, their schooling. There's a couple people who are getting ready to start school, getting ready for EMT school or nursing school. Overall, it's overwhelming grief and also just love sharing memories, sharing condolences, and just sharing support.
Yeah, so many of them were young and so many of them Latino. So any special messages from the Latino community?
So we've noticed a lot of outpouring of support from Puerto Rico. A lot of the victims have ties to Puerto Rico, were born there, or still have significant family there. And it's been, like Emily said, a lot of disbelief. I think some of the hardest messages were last night when we started following this. People weren't sure if their loved one was going to make it or not. And then many of them found out this morning that, in fact, their loved one had passed away, although they didn't hear until very late last night or early this morning. I think simply the amount of casualties made it a much more difficult process.
Yeah, I think what is also horrifying for us just is the ability to witness some of this stuff on social media, because these victims, many of them were young, and they documented their lives on the dance floor moments before the shots rang out in some instances on Snapchat or Instagram or what have you. And so you see some of these chilling videos online.
Exactly.
Alex, let's talk about some of the victims specifically. Beginning with Kimberly Morris, the bouncer that I mentioned. She was 37 years old. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so Kimberly Morris, who goes by KJ, recently moved to Orlando to help out her mother and grandmother. She was living in Hawaii for a number of years after graduating college. She was a college basketball player at Post University in Waterbury, Connecticut. Was really excited to be part of the LGBT community in Orlando. which from what we understand is very vibrant and is a growing community there. An ex-girlfriend spoke to the Orlando Sentinel a couple of hours ago and talked about how excited she was to start her career there and really plant her roots in Central Florida. And part of that was getting this job as a bouncer at Pulse nightclub, where she unfortunately lost her life.
And another man, his name is Luis Vielma, 22 years old, and he worked at the Harry Potter ride at Universal Orlando,
yeah.
And J.K. Rowling tweeted about him.
Yeah, one of his friends said he's freaking out right now, and he said that he can imagine Luis just freaking out over the fact that J.K. Rowling mentioned him and offered her condolences.
Yeah,
yeah, I actually spoke to some of his friends from youth group, and they all described him as truly a leader in their church community, where he was always the first person to greet a new face that walked through the door and really provide leadership for some of the younger students who were trying to find their way in the church community. He was also very proud of his Mexican heritage. Apparently his Facebook was filled with videos of him juggling a soccer ball. He was actually planning on going on a mission trip to Richmond, Virginia with some of the other members of the youth group as a leader to really help people experience a mission trip and continue pursuing a relationship with God. That was very important to him.
And Edward Sotomayor Jr., he was 34 years old. And what do we know about him?
So Edward was one of the first names announced last night. He was a national brand manager for a gay travel agency and was really a big part of the larger Florida gay community. He was originally from Sarasota nearby. And originally, we found out in our reporting, he met up with what turned out to be his cousin a couple of years ago at the Orlando's Gay Days Festival. Just happened to be a chance meeting, and they found out they were related to each other. And the last time they ran into each other was during the filming for RuPaul's Drag Race, the reality television show, earlier this year. And from what we can understand, he was a really visible part of the LGBT community in Central Florida and was really beloved by all who met him.
And tell us about a few more. Who else stood out in your reporting?
So one person that really stood out to me was Luis Daniel Wilson Leon. He actually grew up in Puerto Rico, and I spoke to his childhood friend, and he told me a really harrowing tale about how they grew up in a strict Pentecostal church, although they were loved by each of their families. And eventually they came out to each other, and they were the only people who knew of each other's sexual orientation for a number of years, and both actually moved to Florida a couple of years later and continued to live with one another and support one another as they were getting settled in the United States. And it was just told by his friend Daniel that he was just always there and always a rock. And he actually, his partner was with him, Juan Carlos Mendez Perez, was with him at the club and also passed away in the shooting.
Seemed like there were several couples who were there at the club.
Yes, night. Yes.
And it wasn't just couples, too. There were groups of friends. There was a pair of women, Amanda and Mercedes. They had known each other for 12 years, and the club was a place that they'd go with some of their friends when everyone had time off from work to really just relax and catch up with each other.
So what's happening? What's the scene now outside the club, and what are people telling you in the gay community about the club and whether or not they will return to it when it is eventually reopened?
From what we've heard from other reporters, the club was really a home for a lot of people in the Orlando community, and not just members of the LGBTQ community, but the straight community as well. It was really a symbol of unity for a lot of people in the community. Neither of us are in Orlando, but it seems like while the club, the staff, the people who went there, while they're all shaken, I think it'll take more than this tragedy to bring this community down. Everyone is really rallying in terms of donating blood, offering support, condolences. GoFundMes have sprung up across the internet for not just the victims and their families, but for the staff of the club who probably will be out of work as the police continue to investigate. There's just really been an outpouring of support from not just the LGBTQ community, but the Florida community as a whole.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
That's Emily Cochran and Alex Daugherty, reporters for the Miami Herald. We just heard the Pulse was a place of refuge for the LGBTQ community in Orlando. All over the country, gay bars and nightclubs serve as sanctuaries. We're going to talk about that with Dave Cullen. He's an expert on mass shootings, and every time another tragic incident like what happened at Pulse happens, his inbox is just flooded with interview requests. And when things finally settle down for him, he goes to his place of refuge, and as a gay man, that means a gay bar. Dave Cullen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When you heard that 49 people were killed in Orlando, what were your first thoughts?
Well, my first thought right before that was a weird kind of unexpected denial because I was in a family reunion yesterday, and we just got back to my sister's house in Chicago, and I saw my email that there was some shooting, and I thought, oh, God. Not again, but I didn't really want to deal with it. And my nephew said, yeah, it was a gay bar, and it's apparently pretty bad. And I can't explain this to you now, but I just didn't accept it. And I just sort of brushed it off, which makes no sense, until a minute later I checked my email, and then I saw what happened, and then I had the reaction I should have, which was shock. And I burst out crying, which I can't remember the last time that's happened with any of these, because normally my brain is sort of horrified but kind of goes right to work and dealing
right
with it. And this time I didn't go to work. I just went to the...
Because this hit your community. This is...
Yeah, it was just close to home. I mean, I really think of gay people as just our people. I mean, it's weird. I guess I think of it as our tribe, which is this weird kind of thing. But it's just like it's us, and they attacked us and killed, some of our folks.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the gay bar as a place of sanctuary, as a place of more than just going out to meet friends and have a good time, but a place to really find yourself and your identity.
It really is, and I think almost everybody coming up, even if you're coming out in high school, I'm not sure that people come all the way out. There's different parts of coming out, and part is like admitting that, the big hurdle is admitting that you're gay, but the rest is really finding your personality and how you act and relate to other people. And I think especially people of my generation, nobody came out in high school. But even now, you don't really know who you are. And all the other kids in high school are figuring out that in really kind of, awkward teenage ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're, the whole dating process or just asking somebody out or like, giggling around girls or, being afraid to speak. All of that stuff goes on. And it takes, all of that lessons, 5 or 10 years to sort of work it out. And you can't just work it out in your head. Whereas gay kids are sort of putting all that on hold. They're kind of faking so many things and holding back. And they don't really know who they are. They haven't tried it out. You can't know. I mean, I don't think most people really sort of know who they are or until they, try doing it. And
mm-hmm.
by going to gay bars, is sort of like the main place for most of us where you work that out. And you don't find it out the first night. You find it out over time. And I think it's got a central place in our lives still because of that.
Well, also, maybe, when you're living in a straight world, it's a place where you can actually, even if you're out, as you say, you can fully be yourself. And
right. Yeah, right. Yes. And of course, before you do come out, I think most people still, that's where they sort of like test out the waters first and see what it's like. And I know, I did. I was maybe a gay special ed student. I mean, I didn't touch a man until I was 28, and then I had my 7-year experimental and then bi phase where I was still not, still not accepting the obvious. But all of those, and I wasn't, for most of that, I wasn't telling anyone because I had to just, a friend of mine said, oh, you're experimenting. How many times do you need to rerun this experiment? But apparently a lot before I was willing to accept it.
Even though you're going to gay bars?
Oh, yeah. Because I was still dating women at the same time. Uh-huh. So I was sort of, going both. And it's weird stories we tell ourselves. Most of the gay people, I'm in my 50s now, and most of the people in my generation have kind of similar stories. Hardly anybody's like, okay, the first night I tried it and I knew. But most of us, because we were dragged kicking and screaming, I didn't want to be gay. That was horrible. I mean, it was about the worst possible thing someone could tell you. It was like one step up or maybe below from being diagnosed with cancer. The good news is you don't have cancer. The bad news, you're gay.
Right.
So we wouldn't accept it. But going there, in a lot of the cities I went to, they had the windows. And I think smaller cities, especially places, like even I was just with Austin, all Ken Herring's is one of the big places, and their windows are all blacked out. So it's safe, literally, once you go in, you pass through that door, there might be panic, and I remember the early days, the panic, just to get from the parking lot into the door because I felt exposed of anybody driving by might see me. But the minute you pass through that doorway, it closes behind you, and you're safe in there. If anybody does see you, it's mutually assured destruction. They're in there, too.
So this was at the Pulse Latin night.
Yes.
And do you think that was significant and in the gay world? And what does that mean?
Yeah, very much so. Until 5 years ago, I lived in Denver for a long time, which is a large Latino population. And for whatever reason, I connect with them. So most of my gay friends, or about half or more, were Latinos. And I learned very quickly how much harder it is for most of them culturally to be gay and with their families. In fact, one of the things I did not put in my Vanity Fair piece that I did in one of the early drafts is I have a friend, I guess I can say it on his name on LA radio, Alex is one of my best friends. And for about a year, we would go out together every Saturday night to the dance club Trax in Denver. And he wasn't completely out to his family, some members and some not. And I was really encouraging him, then pushing him to just sort of, pull the trigger on that. And, Alex, just tell them it'll be fine. They'll love you more. It won't be nearly as bad as you thought. And then one Saturday night, he was all beaten up. And he had told his brother, they're both in their 20s, beat the out of him. I hope I can say that word. But really beat the crap out of him. And that really brought it home to me that, I kind of knew this, but I guess I wasn't taking it seriously enough. Nobody beat me up in my family when I told them. I was afraid what would happen, but there was no risk of that. I'm quite certain that of those, whatever the count is right now, 53 or whatever it is, injured people, I would think quite a few of those are still not out. Mm-hmm. And their parents probably found out they were gay when they were notified that their son or daughter was in the hospital.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And for all the gay people out there, I hope you're getting through it okay.
Dave Cullen. He's the author of Columbine and the upcoming Soldiers First. It's the story of two gay soldiers before and after Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And we want to hear from you. What have gay bars meant to you in your life? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it didn't take long for the shooting to become politicized. We'll look at how the presidential candidates are reacting next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A familiar pattern has emerged in the aftermath of the tragedy in Orlando. Democrats are calling for new gun laws, Republicans calling for a crackdown on terrorists. And that divide is now playing out in the reactions from the two presumptive presidential nominees. In a speech in Cleveland today, Hillary Clinton called for some sort of restrictions on the ownership of assault weapons.
We have to make it harder for people who should not have those weapons of war. And that may not stop every shooting or every terrorist attack, but it will stop some, and it will save lives, and it will protect our first responders.
Donald Trump also spoke today. He said today's administration is hampered by political correctness.
If we don't get tough, and if we don't get smart and fast, we're not going to have our country anymore. There will be nothing, absolutely nothing left.
Well, joining us now, Juliet Alperin, White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
I assume you monitored both speeches. What were the takeaways in terms of their differences, the two candidates?
They were dramatically different, as we've seen throughout this campaign. So to take Hillary Clinton first, since she spoke earlier in Cleveland, you really saw kind of very similar to the president, this idea of, first of all, emphasizing the importance of diversity and tolerance in the context of both members of the LGBT community and Muslims in America, and the idea that it's important that that kind of Islam broadly not be confused with what happened here specifically, but also a call for further restrictions on firearms, including the AR-15. And as well as, you know, she talked about other ways to, you know, she would try to make things safer, but that was one of, you know, kind of the main policy thrust you see coming out of there. Whereas Donald Trump gave a speech in New Hampshire, which again, it's also worth noting that Clinton did not directly kind of identify Trump or go after him. Mm-hmm. Trump, when he spoke later in New Hampshire, really went after Clinton specifically, talked about how neither she nor the president knew what they were doing, and really what he made central to his speech is the idea of curbs on immigration. He questioned what the value was of immigration when it came to admitting people from the Mid-East, and essentially said it was essential that there be severe restrictions, even though they'd be temporary, in order to ensure that Americans are safe from this kind of threat in the future.
All right, let's hear him say that.
When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats.
Is this him doubling down on what he has said previously, or is this something new?
It is. He is really doubling down on what he stated previously, and what we saw in terms of polling is that his push for a ban on all Muslim immigrants served him very well in the Republican primary. And there is an open question about how that will play out in the general election, and I think that's something that remains to be seen. But this is a position he's held in the past. He's not changing it, but in fact emphasizing that it's central to his approach to tackling domestic terrorism.
And as you say, he took on Hillary Clinton rather forcefully, and he mocked her for refusing and then deciding to utter the words radical Islam. That may just be semantics, and national security experts maybe say that doesn't matter what the terminology is, but why is it repeatedly being brought up in this campaign, that term, whether or not you're going to say radical Islam?
Right. It's become certainly something that many Republican candidates have emphasized, and it has been this dividing line traditionally between Republicans and Democrats, where Democrats have emphasized that using that term is not helpful because it feeds into a narrative that Islam is at war with the West, and therefore we shouldn't target Islam more broadly. The President Obama refuses to use that term and often talks about the perversion of Islam. It's interesting that earlier today, Hillary Clinton did use a form of that term on television, and so maybe she thought that by using it, she would diffuse that criticism. But of course, in a way that you could argue is quite understandable, Donald Trump is trying to hold her to account for the fact that she's refrained from using it in the past.
But what they're both saying is there are two different motivations when it comes to this shooting. One is radical Islam on the part of Donald Trump and the right, and the other on the left and Hillary Clinton is access to guns.
Yes, I mean, I think what they're saying. I mean, you know, I think that there no one at this point. I mean, the investigation is ongoing.
Right.
It certainly seems clear that the gunman was Omar Martin was inspired in part by the Islamic State, otherwise known as ISIL or ISIS, and so there is, you know, a connection there. And I don't think that Hillary Clinton would deny that. But certainly, in terms of a policy prescription, Democrats and Republicans are taking very different lessons.
Right. And so there's, again, the call for some kind of gun control on the part of the left and on the right.
Right.
None. So do we expect the same thing, that there will just be nothing actionable, nothing happening in Congress?
Yes, sometimes having covered multiple mass shootings and things like this, you do feel a little like it's Groundhog Day, where you have these calls for action. There seems no real possibility of legislation passing this Congress, but it is true that this has become an issue in the presidential campaign in a way we have not seen for a while, and so you could possibly see a change next year, and I think that's really what it's about. Donald Trump made a point of saying that he was going to meet with the National Rifle Association soon to talk about what he could do to bolster Americans' access to guns to address the threat of domestic terrorism. So, again, you see a very different tactic and approach, which certainly would have policy implications come next year.
Juliet Opperin is White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of the political reactions you're hearing to this tragedy in Orlando? Any political leaders setting the right tone? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY. Or you can reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, novelist Adam Haslett is here. His new book is about how the mental illness of one family member infects the entire family.
It's not so much guilt that one isn't mentally ill as guilt at experiencing happiness or joy or ease when that's something that someone you love very much can't have.
That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Bram. It's summer in Maine, and 7-year-old Alec and his 9-year-old sister Celia are rowing a boat on the lake with their dad. He lies down, closes his eyes, and says to them, "Imagine me gone." They're supposed to be getting a lesson in how to guide the boat safely to shore on their own in case something happens to him. Well, it turns out to be more than a simple lesson in lake safety. It's a preview for the lives Alec, Celia, and their older brother Michael will soon have to live after their father kills himself. Imagine Me Gone is the title of the new novel by Adam Haslett. It's the story of a family trying to cope with mental illness. Adam Haslett is here now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Great to have you. So I understand that this is actually based, loosely at least, on your own life and your own situation with your father who committed suicide when you were 14 years old. How much of this book is based on your experiences?
I took the seeds of what happened in my own family, most notably, as you say, that my father killed himself when I was 14. And then I had to figure out a way to shape that material into a novel and a meaningful whole. So I had to give myself permission to depart from the facts. So each of these characters bears some resemblance to members of my own family, but In the end, it wound up being more of what I think of as a kind of counterfactual history of my family, about the what ifs, the could have beens, because I think we all have two families in a sense. We have our actual family that we spend time with and we see, and we have an imagined family, the people that we imagine our closest loved ones to be when we're not present. In a way, it was those imagined members of the family that I was creating a story about.
One of those members of the family is Michael, the older brother, who also has a mental illness. He inherits, I suppose, from his father. And you also had an older brother, have an older brother.
Yes. No, I had an older brother. He's no longer alive.
Oh, okay. Did he also commit suicide?
Not. It was a complicated story, much in the way that it is in the book. It had to do with his ongoing struggle with severe anxiety and with the medications he was on, and which is another place where I definitely was departing from the facts in terms of how the book is structured and how the plot around that storyline actually takes place.
And Michael, he's, as a boy, he's bright, he's precocious, he becomes obsessed with music, and he's obsessed with disco at the beginning, gets into electronic music, EDM, ska. What is it about music that is so appealing to him?
Well, I think he's a highly sensitive person who doesn't have outlets for the things that are coming into him, in a sense, and the music, particularly at high volumes, gives him a sense of his own body, of his own physicality, and it's a way to connect. It's also a way to connect with other people, because he writes about music, he sells music in record shops, and is an evangelist for the music that he loves. So it's a way that he gets out of his own solitude and anxiety towards other people.
Is it a way for him to calm down, to relax?
Yeah, I would say that too. I think that's right. It's a way to escape the present, to transcend the moments that he finds himself in. And he finds, I think, yeah, it's as close as he gets to some kind of transcendence.
You write the story of this family from the different perspectives of the various family members, of Michael, of Alec, of Celia, of the mom, and also John, the dad. And Michael, you really capture his obsessions and his anxiety and his thinking, his mental illness. How did you do that? Had you talked to your own brother about, you know, what he was thinking? And
it's more sort of an imaginative leap, because I knew that I wanted to get some of the hilarity and absurdity and humor that sometimes goes along with kind of desperate situations. I mean, we often laugh hardest with the people we know the best in sort of desperate circumstances sometimes. And just describing anxiety, and in the case of the father, his struggles with depression, it wouldn't really get at what even in my own family was an experience sometimes of the humor that went along with these sort of absurd situations. And so I came upon this idea of parodying forms that Michael would fill out. So he speaks to the reader more indirectly than the other characters, but with this great frantic kind of energy. But it also is a way for the reader to get into to see past what he's telling them to the condition that he's actually in.
Yeah, so he's filling out an application for graduate school. He's filling out a survey, I suppose, about all the medicine he has been on and when he began taking his medicine for something else. And he writes a letter to his aunt when he's young, which I found really funny. At first, I believed it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I'm
but
glad,
it turns
glad
out to be
that.
Totally made up.
Yes. No, he's on a cruise ship, and in the fanciful letter he writes, it's Donna Summer is the main stage entertainment.
Alec and Celia are ostensibly the most high-functioning. They're not the ones struggling with mental illness, and yet their lives are completely colored by their brother and their father's mental illness. And, I mean, it affects them and their relationships. And is that the case in your life, that when you're in a family where there is mental illness, everybody becomes a part of it?
I think so. I mean, I think the metaphor that I came up with was the idea of a slow-moving storm. I think mental illness in a family is like that, because it doesn't stay still. The severity of it and the course of it waxes and wanes over the course of a person's life, and therefore the reaction of the family to it waxes and wanes also. And that's sort of the tension I wanted to dramatize. It's been one of the things that being out in the world with the book has struck me most is how much it seems to bring out the stories of readers' own lives that they've sort of shared with me once they've read it, where a sibling or a parent, whatever the nature of the trouble might be, that they feel the frustrations of how do you help someone when the ways you help them may not work. We want the people we love to be happy, and we want them to be happy often in the ways that we think they should be. And that itself can distort how we help them or shape how we help them.
Yeah, so it's the perspective of what are we helping them to become?
Yes, yes. Well, because I think that's the other thing that I realized after finishing the writing of it in a way was that you help people also to become the person you need them to become. I mean, you have your own needs. You're not an objective person, and no family member is. And often they've become people quite apart from the family. They've become adults and individuals, and you still see them in light of your original experience of them and what the family wants them to be. And I think that's one of the reasons I wrote it from five different points of view, is because I wanted the reader to get that experience of seeing from the inside of one character how they experience themselves, and then the differences, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle, of how the other members of their family perceive them.
The father, he says, John, he says, there is no getting better. There are the medicines I can take that flood my mind, moving the struggle underwater, but there is no killing the beast. Are there some illnesses? Are there some things that just can't be fixed?
Well, I mean, that chapter is spoken from the point of view of someone who's, on the last day of his life. I mean, I think that people obviously experience very severe states of depression, and people kill themselves. I don't think that means that in any given circumstance someone can't be helped. But I also think that there's a temptation for us to look away from that experience. It's one of the reasons there remains stigma about mental illness, because somehow there's still a sense that a shame attaches to it, because it's the responsibility of the person feeling it as opposed to what they're suffering from.
Well, and then Alec tries the opposite approach. He thinks that by getting Michael off the medicine that will provide clarity and will help him. And
there I think there's a mixed motivation, because this is towards the end of the book, and he's it covers almost 40 years in the life of the family, and he's at that point quite frustrated with the ongoing and accumulating effects of his brother's anxiety and inability to thrive on his own in many ways. So, you know, there again is one of those situations, loving and yet also tragic, where the care that one sibling has for another is intermixed with anger for the condition that person's in. And I think that's remarkably common, that we care for and love and want to help people at the same time that we're angry at having to do it.
Is that how you felt with your brother?
I think when I said earlier this, the idea of the sort of imaginary family, I think James Baldwin has this great line where he says any artist, if they are to survive, must let the anguish out, all of it, the literal and the fanciful. And I think there is fanciful anguish too. There is imaginary anguish. And that's what I was dealing with as much as the literal grief, which I think is a process that happens, you know, beside, alongside, and through art sometimes. But they're in some ways different processes, because I'm always concerned about a reader here. I'm trying to create an experience that someone who knows nothing about me or my family is going to get through the reading of this book. So I can't rely on any prior knowledge, obviously. Mm.
Do you or do your characters ever feel guilty for not being mentally ill, for surviving, if you will?
I mean, in the book, they're so focused on the kind of emergency of Michael, the older brother's condition, that they spend less time, I think, being guilty, although there are parts of that. I mean, Alex certainly feels guilty for getting into a relationship that is lasting because it's been such a struggle for Michael to do that. So, yeah, I think it's not so much guilt that one isn't mentally ill as guilt at experiencing happiness or joy or ease when that's something that someone you love very much can't have.
So did you get all the demons out? Did you exercise them?
Oh, well, that would probably be a tall order. But the word catharsis, I've studied philosophy and aesthetics and the idea that if Aristotle, you go to a play and these feelings are excited and then you leave and they've been washed out of you and there's this sense of sort of ease and clarity. And I really had that in writing this. I don't think it means you ever have to stop going to plays or stop reading novels or maybe stop writing them, but I definitely had that experience writing this book.
Well, Adam Hassel, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Adam Hassel. He's the author of a new novel. It's called Imagine Me Gone. And coming up on this program, Omar Mateen used an AR-15 semi-automatic assault weapon at the Pulse nightclub. How the AR-15 became the weapon of choice in mass shootings. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Gun control is being debated today, as it is after every shooting, and one gun in particular, the AR-15.
Well, in Orlando and San Bernardino, terrorists used assault weapons, the AR-15, and they used it to kill Americans. That was the same assault weapon used to kill those little children in Sandy Hook.
Hillary Clinton, in a speech she gave today, to find out more about the AR-15 and why it seems to be the weapon of choice in many of these shootings, we've called up Adam Winkler. He's a law professor at UCLA and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, has this gun, in fact, become the weapon of choice for these mass shooters?
It may seem so. They have been involved in a number of high-profile mass shootings, from Newtown to the Aurora Theater shooting to the San Bernardino shooting just some months ago. However, if you look at the data, mass shooting is, like most kinds of crime, mostly a product of handguns. In fact, of a Mother Jones inquiry into the guns used in mass shootings not too long ago, found that there were only 20 assault rifles used in about 140 mass shootings. So handguns really still are the weapon of choice for all criminals, including mass shooters.
And he did have a handgun with him as well.
That's right.
So there are calls to ban assault weapons, but not calls to ban handguns. And I remember there used to be calls to ban handguns many decades ago. Why not anymore?
Well, in 2008, the Supreme Court held in a case called District of Columbia against Heller that the Second Amendment protects your right to have a handgun in your home for self-protection and struck down Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns. As a result, a ban on handguns is not only politically impossible, but constitutionally impermissible.
So that leaves the assault weapons, and there was an assault weapons ban that expired. Do you think that there will again be renewed calls to enact an assault weapons ban? And if so, what would the likelihood be of its passing?
We have already seen renewed calls arise just in the last 24 hours for enacting an assault weapons ban. I don't think the prospects for an assault weapons ban are being passed by Congress are promising at all. This is the most popular rifle among gun enthusiasts. They don't want to see this firearm banned. They argue with some reason that these guns are very rarely used in criminal activity. Only a tiny fraction of annual gun fatalities are traceable to these firearms.
Who uses AR-15s and what do they use them for?
Well, like I say, AR-15s have become the most popular rifle among shooters. You know, if you're a gun enthusiast, a hobbyist who goes to the gun range and likes to fire your gun, this gun has become incredibly popular. It's got cool military styling, the kind of thing that offends some people is exactly what appeals to some people who are real shooters. It's lightweight, it's very accurate, and it's also highly customizable. You can put on lots of your own components and make it really your own gun. Some people have even likened it to the iPhone, where you can put on your own apps and really make the gun yours.
And how many rounds does it hold?
Well, it depends. If you're buying one in California, it doesn't hold that many because California has more restrictive laws. But at the national level, these assault rifles will typically hold anywhere from 18 to 30 rounds of ammunition.
And then how easy is it to reload?
It's very easy to reload. All you need to do is have another magazine preloaded, ready to go. You just press a button. The old expended magazine with no more rounds of ammunition pops out. You pop the new one in, and you're ready to go. It can be done in just a matter of seconds.
And what are the effects? Is getting shot by one, is the wound different than from a handgun?
Well, a rifle is a more powerful firearm than the typical handgun. But assault rifles are not the most powerful kinds of rifles. For instance, we have deer hunting rifles that are much bigger, shoot a higher capacity, a round of ammunition that's bigger and more powerful, higher caliber. That was the word I was looking for. And there are handguns that can shoot a larger caliber ammunition than the typical assault rifle, too. So they're rifles, so they're deadly, and they shoot a powerful round of ammunition, but they're not necessarily the most powerful.
But you say the AR-15 is the most popular for its styling, for its availability?
Not necessarily for its availability. Look, there are six times as many gun dealers in America as there are Starbucks. So availability is not a real problem for most guns. So the gun is available. It's actually a pretty expensive kind of firearm. It's just a kind of firearm that if you're a real gun enthusiast, you really like this gun. It's accurate. It's lightweight. It's easy to use. Like I say, you can customize it. It's a very popular weapon. And for a shooter, they don't really see the difference between this gun and many of the other rifles that are not outlawed under an assault weapons ban that shoot more powerful rounds of ammunition.
And I understand this was modeled on the M16, the military rifle. When did it make the leap over to becoming a civilian gun?
Just over the last 30 years, we've seen an increasing demand for civilians to buy these types of firearms. Unlike the M16, which was a firearm that had a little switch that you could make it a machine gun, so it shoots automatically. One pull of the trigger shoots lots of rounds of ammunition. The civilian variants only shoot one round of ammunition at a time and cannot be automatic or machine guns. Those weapons are already banned under federal law.
Has this gun become the symbol for both sides?
I think it has in many ways. Many in the gun control community see this symbol as evidence that we've gone too far with our permissiveness on guns, that we're allowing people to have what they consider to be weapons of war. And for many in the gun community, it's a symbol of how irrational gun control advocates are, that they want to prohibit one particular type of gun that's not even associated with a lot of crime. They might liken this to saying, what gun control advocates are trying to do is to reduce drunk driving by outlawing scotch, when you still allow people to drink vodka, rum, or other alcohol.
But gun control advocates would likely say, well, that's maybe the only thing we can get done. We'd rather ban all guns, but we know that's impossible.
Well, it's possible that that's what they would say, although many in the gun control community say that they don't want to ban all guns. They just want to ban the particularly dangerous ones, which puts the burden on them, really, to show that this gun is unusually dangerous. And especially in the wake of a mass shooting like this, it might seem real easy to say that gun is responsible. It's not hard to imagine that the Orlando shooter, however, could have done just as much damage had he been loaded up with a bunch of handguns.
Adam Winkler, law professor at UCLA and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
Hello. Earlier on in the show, we talked about the gay club as a sanctuary for people. And we asked our listeners to call in and tell us how gay clubs affected their lives. We had a listener called Phil who called into our voicemail line, and he wanted to talk about the first time he ever walked into a gay bar.
When I walked in, I felt I was home. I felt I was safe. I felt like I had been missing most of my life because I hadn't been there before. And in the 80s and 90s, the gay clubs were my home. And I'm very sorry for those people.
So that's what Phil wanted to talk about today. And it's obviously hitting the gay community and everybody who cares about this kind of thing pretty hard. Adam Battaglia left a message on our Facebook page. He says that he moved to LA in the 90s when he was in his early 20s, and he spent many nights rocking out with other gay people in the safety of the gay bar scene in West Hollywood. And he says that that helped him grow into the confident person that he is today. And he hates that the safe bubble of that sanctuary has been pierced by hatred. We had a lot of other people that wanted to share their stories. They called in. They left messages. Twitter is always a good place. When you share it on Facebook, everybody can see it, and you can kind of start to build the safe community there. So we want to hear from you about your experiences in gay bars.
We are all Orlando.
Hashtag.
Hashtag. We are all Orlando. And then some. All right, Julie Myers, thank you very much. Again, we'd love to hear from you about all your experiences and in gay bars. Well, maybe not all, but formative ones at KCRW Press Play, and any other comments you have on the show are totally welcome. Julie Myers, thank you very much, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.